Well, good morning, everybody. It was a very inspiring opening of our advisory council, I must say. Bad news is that two very valued board members will be leaving us at the end of June. Our Japanese board member, Tak Ochi, and our Brazilian board member, Amaro Gomes. But the good news is that we have found adequate, more than adequate replacement. On the left, you see Tadeu Sandon, a new board member from Brazil. And to the right, you see Rika Suzuki, and as her name indicates, she is from Japan. Tadeu Sandon has served as the Director for Professional Development at the Brazilian Institute of Independent Auditors, IBRACON, and he joins from PwC in Brazil, where he's a partner advising multinational companies that use IFRS. And you'll get to meet him, and you will probably agree with me that he's a very sharp cookie indeed. Rika has been involved with the Japanese standard setter, focusing on IFRS implementation, and she has also chaired the Japanese professional body working group on Japan's modified international standards, the JMIs, which fortunately have never been used. And she also joins from PwC in Japan, a total coincidence. Probably the two persons never met in their lives, but both technically very strong board members, and I'm sure they'll make a very good contribution to the board. Then the standard that will probably return a couple more times to this advisory council. I want to tell you a little bit about where we are in terms of implementation support. I don't think we have ever issued a standard which we gave so much implementation support as this standard, in the form of webinars, videos, podcasts, three TRG meetings with over 100 questions considered, endless meetings with investors and regulators. We met with over 650 investors and analysts, and many technical discussions, over 200 meetings with insurers, audit firms, and standard setters. In the TRG, a lot of issues came up, brought up by the industry, about 25, and we have always made clear this is a big change. Probably there will be unforeseen things, and we'll take a closer look. And to our, I think our own surprise, we decided to make no fewer than seven smaller changes to the standards, in most cases small, but very important to the industry in terms of implementation costs and also in terms of what they feel is faithful representation of their performance. We have looked at acquisitions costs, at reinsurance, profit allocation for some contracts. We found out that some contracts, if we only looked at the insurance component, would have upfront recognition of almost all the profits, while there was also a big investment component. So we have, that was a fair point to look at. We have looked at balance sheet presentation and transition. We, in our last meeting, we have also paid attention to a very important issue, which is the level of aggregation. To what extent can insurance companies group contracts together? And I think it's fair to say that the insurance industry would like to group as many contracts as possible together, whereas we have said, well, we want at least contracts in one group to be no longer than 1 year apart. Because if you have de facto open portfolios, what you get is spreading out of profits over the years. You get almost unfettered mingling of onerous contracts with profitable contracts, so that onerous contracts can never be identified. And if you really want to have an insight in the performance of an insurance company, in the profitability trends, you need to set a limit on the level of aggregation of these contracts. If you wouldn't do so, in principle, it's possible, and it would happen in practice, that old contracts would continue contributing to profits recognized in a certain year, even long after they have expired. And I'm still waiting for the first insurer to explain to me why that is proper accounting. I don't believe that is proper accounting. Nevertheless, that remains a contentious issue, but we have decided to stay firm there. Otherwise, we feel that an important, very important heart of the standard would be removed from the standard. Few comments on IBOR. Perhaps you know that as a result of all the scandals around LIBOR, among others, manipulation of these important interest rate benchmarks, regulators around the world have started to develop alternative benchmarks. Now, where this all will lead is, what is sure is that LIBOR, etc., will disappear, but it is not quite clear yet by what they will be replaced. And that raises two important questions. First of all, for hedge accounting, it is very important for a preparer, for a bank, that it is relatively sure about where the contracts will land. If there is not enough level of confidence about what the future benchmark will rate will be, strictly speaking, the hedging accounting relationship would fall apart, and they could not continue with their hedging practices. So we really needed to do something. We have decided to propose to amend IFRS 9 and IAS 39 so that companies can continue their hedging accounting arrangements despite the present uncertainty over IBOR reform, and we've just decided to issue a change with a comment period of 45 days, which would normally be found scandalously short, but given that this is to help people, I'm sure people will find it more than acceptable. And then once it is clear what LIBOR, etc., will be replaced with, then we'll have to look at whether the future benchmarks can, whether we need our to adapt our hedging requirements to this new benchmark. But that is something for future concern. Then let me say a couple of things about our primary financial statements project. And I gave a speech on this 2 weeks ago in Mexico, and I said in that speech that I think that our decisions in this area could be a game changer in financial reporting. We believe it is, as I told you before, it is incredibly important to improve the format and the structure of the financial statements, that we don't just prescribe revenue and we don't just prescribe profit or loss, but that we also prescribe some subtotals in between, because that is what almost all investors want to see. They want to see what is approximately operating income, and they also want to see a picture of a company irrespective of its finance structure in many cases. And at present, that is, we don't prescribe anything. Every company does it in its own way, and it is a bit of a wild west without sufficient discipline. And we also think that more structure in a financial statement is extremely important for comparability and also for the digital consumption of financial information. So thus far, we have introduced a few subtotals, the most important of which are operating profit, which excludes the share of profit from all associates and investments and interest. Operating profit is today the most commonly used non-GAAP measure, but every company does it in its own way. And I am sure that the way that we have decided to define operating income, that many companies will still want to make their own adjustments, but at least then there is an anchor for operating income in IFRS much closer by than currently is the case, so the reconciliations will be much more transparent. And I also hope that once we define something, that perhaps in practice there will be some sort of spontaneous convergence between all these non-GAAP measures with the measure as defined by us. Also important is the profit before financing and income tax. That comes very close to an EBIT-like subtotal, and that really gives a view of a company irrespective of the fact whether it's predominantly credit financed or whether it's primarily equity financed, and that is something that is very important for investors to know. What is perhaps equally important is that we will provide more discipline around disaggregation. Investors complain that in very many cases, and we've seen them as we worked through the issues of companies that have like over 50% of their expenses in other expenses, and something cannot be right there. So we will be, we have developed, I think, some workable principles to prevent that from happening. And what I also believe is extremely important is that only last week we decided to develop high-level guidance and that we will require companies to give an overview in their notes of what they see as unusual items in their expenses, both their expenses and their revenues. That is something that almost every company gives in their non-GAAP measures, underlying profits, adjusted profits. And what is the case, mostly the case in current practice, is that companies primarily focus on what they see as unusual expenditures, take them out, get a more rosy picture of the financial performance, but almost nobody looks at what might be windfall profits or unusual profits that are not likely to recur in a future period. So if only we succeed in providing more symmetry in the presentation of what are unusual items, and we bring them in the notes and they will be audited, I think that will already give a lot of additional discipline, even though it is not likely that we can give a completely perfect definition of what an unusual item is. So I believe this is probably one of the most important parts of this project. Let me pause here and I'll be happy to answer any questions should they arise.
Are there any questions from the members on those key aspects of what the ongoing projects are for the ISB? No? Oh, Isabel.
A few words on other topics. It's financial instruments with characteristic of equity. Because the International Cooperative Alliance shares the idea that financial innovation since IAS 32 requires to revise this standard. And at this stage, IFRS are applied by different business entities. And the DPE at this stage has not considered in detail the business model of cooperative entities. We acknowledge that the provision of IFRIC 2 should be maintained, but IFRIC 2 does not cover the second criterion, which didn't exist under iOS 32. We believe it is essential to adapt and provide a stable framework for cooperative entities and to integrate IFRIC 2 in the revised version of iOS 32. Thank you.
Probably Nili is going to say a little bit more about VICE. All I can say is that it has been the firm intention of the board not to change current practice for cooperatives, and we have decided that in the board meeting. So if that's not sufficiently clear, we might have to clear that up. We are still processing all the information, the feedback that we got from the outside world. I must say that from the outside we thought that the problems and variety in practice were rather limited, enough so that we have to do something about the classification of certain instruments as either equity or liability, but that from the outreach that we have done and the feedback that we have received, our impression is that the problems are bigger than we thought they were. That for that reason, it is likely that that we'll have to decide that some standard setting is necessary. But perhaps it's safe if I give the floor to Sue, who knows these issues much better than I do.
I just wanted to make one specific comment on your point on IFRIC 2. I know the issue that's come up, and it's linked to the amount feature. We haven't looked at the detailed feedback on the comments yet. I've read the comment letters, but the board needs to look at the detailed feedback on the classification and measurement, and I know that will be one of the things that we'll be looking at, is that very particular interaction that you're mentioning.
Okay, there are a couple more questions here. Just be aware that Neely is going to cover a few more technical aspects. So unless they are specifically on things that Hans has covered, perhaps we'll go to Neely first. So if they are, and I'm aware Lotta and Olaf. So Lotta, if you want to ask your question now, or wait till Neely's covered her presentation. Your call.
Yeah, thanks. It's just very quick. The Primary Financial Statement Initiative has really come to a very good and targeted issue for users, I'd say. I mean, this is really... will be really helpful. It's really getting non-GAAP measures into a better framework, and that has been very important and will be very important. And I was just asking whether there's any more coming in terms of non-GAAP, like regulation on non-GAAP statements, because there's always this fear from a user side that, yes, to have standards applying and getting a clearer picture is very good, but you don't want to suppress it. You want to have creativity in the non-GAAP field because it's very important to get the information.
Well, our decision making on non-GAAP, as far as we can make decisions on something that we're not responsible for, but it is not finished yet. But I've always said it is not our objective to exterminate non-GAAP, because it can truly be very useful, especially for industry-specific measures that we cannot possibly provide with IFRS. What we do intend to do is to give some more discipline around it by providing more anchors ourselves, and probably also to increase the visibility of non-GAAP measures, perhaps in the notes, and also to require reconciliation to our subtotals. But we are certainly not going to suppress non-GAAP.
Olaf?
Yes, I'll also be quick. I just wanted to make a couple of comments. I think, first of all, you didn't mention the work you are doing on the amortization of goodwill. I think the goodwill issue, I think, is an important one. But okay, come on. I think on IFRS 17, though, I think... I would like to comment that we welcome the work you've been doing. We appreciate the efforts have been put in. I think you're probably aware that there's different views on the degree that has addressed the issues, and we're very much looking forward to continuing discussing achieving further improvements through the exposure draft process. But I did have one question. Could you provide any information on the timeline, both in terms of your target for the exposure draft and also for the final publication, whether you've got anything you can share there?
We are, of course, always looking forward to further discuss with you, but we are very, I think we have reached the end of the line. That's what I would like you to understand. Yeah.
So in terms of the timeline for the exposure draft, we're looking to issue something by the end of the second quarter. So we'll have one more board meeting in April to sort of put the whole package together and seek the board's permission to begin the balloting process. Have the exposure draft go out in Q2, and then a lot of it's going to just depend on the level of feedback that we get from our stakeholders. But ideally, what we plan it will be to come back to the board towards the end of the year, and then have a final standard out or final amendments out next year.
Thanks, Neely. Nigel, I think comment from you.
Thank you. And Hans, thank you for your presentation. Appreciate it. My question is not so much on the projects, but on your first couple of slides with the selection of the board members, the
yes.
new board members. And as you mentioned, there are two PwC folks coming on, so two from the profession. And I don't know if it's, I believe those who are coming off are not from the profession. So, and I know there's careful consideration, obviously, of who gets elected and so forth in the balance. But just going back to that question of balance, has there been sort of a step back to see if that there continues to be a good balance as far as the diversity when you consider two additional members of the firms coming on as compared to those who are there?
Well, our constitution is very specific in terms of diversity as to the geographical diversity of the board, and that we have to apply extremely strictly. It is a little bit less precise about the professional background of people. But clearly, we always want to have a balance between preparers, between investors, between technically very capable people from the audit profession and from regulators. And in there we try to be especially balanced over time, because it's very, if we had very rigid rules about which profession and which geographical background, it would become an impossible task to fulfill. In the past 4 years, Mary Toker was the only former audit partner, a member of the board, so the audit profession was perhaps a little bit underrepresented. Now they will have three, which is still three out of 14, and possibly in the future there'll be two again or one. That we cannot say with mathematical precision, but I think overall there is still a lot of balance in the board. We have quite a few preparers, we have quite a few regulators, so it's not as if one background can dominate the board, and that is certainly not going to happen now either. But thanks for the question, it's a valid question.
Thanks, Nigel and Hans. Now, perhaps just to hand over to Neely to conclude the technical presentation and for our information as to what's going on.